disappearing into the night beneath the light of a moon that's almost full. Back in the lamp-lit guest room, feeling slightly sick from too much chocolate, Lucinda climbs into bed. She can only hope Tess is doing the same thing in her room down the hall, poor kid. Wondering what time it is, Lucinda looks around the room for a clock. There isn't one. It's too early to call Randy, that's for sure. No matter how tempting it is to connect with him on the heels of her conversation with heartbroken Tess. Not that Lucinda is planning to tell him she's realized she's willing to take a chance on an actual relationship with him. It's still too soon for that. But hearing his voice right now wouldn't be such a bad thing. She fishes in her bag for her BlackBerry to check the time. Definitely too early. Leaning back against the pillows again, she closes her eyes, willing sleep to come. Her throat is starting to burn from exhaustion, and she can't afford to lose her voice when she's headed to Manhattan in the morning to see what she can find out about William Zubin. No, don't think about that now. Don't think about anything upsetting. The trouble is, she can't think of anything at this point that's not. So she does her best not to think at all, focusing instead on deep breathing, the way she does when she's trying to conjure a psychic vision on the job. When at last sleep overtakes her, she dreams. At first, it's the puzzle dream. The puzzle is almost done, and there's a missing piece, and she's looking for it. Then she's in a big, deserted factory of some sort, looking everywhere for the puzzle piece. But she can't find it because it's pitch black. Somewhere along the way, the dream shifts gears again the way dreams have a way of doing, and someone is chasing her through the factory, but she doesn't know whom. She keeps trying to scream for help, but her voice is gone. At last, she rounds a corner and sees a big, round beam of light up ahead. Moonlight, she thinks at first, knowing, with that omniscient dream logic, that the moon is full. But there are no windows in the factory, and she sees that it isn't the moon at all. She can make out the silhouette of a man holding a flashlight. It's the night watchman, she realizes. She bolts toward him, blinded by the beam, certain she's about to be saved. Just before she reaches the man, he turns the light to illuminate something he's holding in his other hand, a butcher knife, dripping with blood. He starts to laugh, that horrible, crazy laugh that's been haunting her by day, now echoing through her nightmare. Chapter 18. Walking into the lobby of the sprawling downtown Denver hotel, Vic finds himself surrounded by conventioneers wearing vinyl badge holders advertising some type of marketing conference. How easy it would have been for the unsub to blend into this crowd, perhaps even borrowing a conference badge just long enough to work his way into the business center and send Vic that email from one of the hotel's public-use computers. But the night watchman isn't a legitimate guest here, not even under an assumed name. Of that, Vic is certain. His risks, so far, have been much too calculated for that. Vic makes his way to the business center and finds the double glass doors locked, with a hotel security guard outside. "Sorry, sir, the center is closed right now," the guard tells him. "Why is that?" "Repairs," the guard says tersely. "Uh-huh." Vic can see Annabelle Wyatt inside, along with several other agents. Maybe he should let her know he's here, just in case. Just in case she wants to remind you, again, that you're retired and she doesn't need or want your help. It's not that he'd blame her, or would expect any other response from the Bureau. It's just ironic that the predator he spent so many years trying to catch would reappear only now that it's too late for Vic to be a part of the investigation. Well then, why are you here? Because clearly, the night watchman wants him to be. That email he sent from this hotel was no reckless mistake. He had to know that Vic would trace it and come running. Had to know, too, that Vic would be obligated to turn it over to the FBI, and that they too would be here in a heartbeat. But it's not as though the guy is going to appear out of nowhere to say, "You're probably wondering why I've called you all here today." "Sir, if you need to use a computer, there's one at the bellman's desk," the security guard tells him. In other words, get moving, bub. "Thanks." Vic walks away. He has no idea where he's going, but it isn't the bellman's desk. Randy? In the midst of examining an online bank account as part of the check fraud investigation, he looks up to see Dan Lambert in the doorway. "What's wrong, Dan?" "What makes you think something's wrong?" "The look on your face. Don't ever play poker. You'd lose your shirt." "I have, and I have." Dan walks into the office and closes the door behind him. "Got a minute?" "Yeah." Randy closes out the computer screen. For a split second, he worries that this is about Lucinda, that something's happened to her. But she's not on the island, or even in Philly, so why would Dan be the first to know? And anyway, she'd called Randy just an hour ago. Seeing it was her, he hadn't picked up, still stung by the way she'd lashed out at him last night when he was only trying to help. She left him a message that she was leaving Cam's and headed for New York. "I want to talk to you, Randy. I'm really sorry I hung up on you last night. I just didn't want you to worry about me." Too bad, he'd thought, hearing it. That's what you do when you care about someone. You worry about them. He hasn't called her back.
"I just talked to Frank."
"Yeah? When's he coming back?" "He isn't." Dan sits in the chair beside the desk.
"He's dying, Randy."
"I knew that," Randy realizes, even as the words catch him off guard. He's surprised, yet somewhere deep down inside he had realized something was seriously wrong back when Lucinda asked him about Frank's health. At the time, he was too caught up in Carla's death to give much thought to anything else. Yes, he had asked Frank how he was. Frank had said fine, other than pneumonia. Again, Randy'd had a twinge of misgiving, wondering if it was something more, but he didn't press the issue.
"It's stage 4 lung cancer," Dan tells him.
"Did you talk to him?"
"I got an email. I tried to call, but he's not picking up."
"Maybe he's still in the hospital."
"I called. He was released yesterday."
"And what? Sent home to die?" Dan shakes his head.
"I guess so. And the worst of it is he's all alone. His kids are all far away, and they don't spend much time with him as far as I know. I've always had the impression they blame him for the divorce."
"I've always had the impression Frank blames himself, too. He told me when Carla and I split up not to make the same mistake he did, or I'd wind up like him, alone, with regrets."
Randy didn't tell Frank that it was the marriage that had been a mistake. It was the marriage that had left him feeling alone, with regrets.
"I just remembered something," he tells Dan, sitting up and reaching for the phone.
"What?"
"Not what. Whom?"
"I have to make a phone call, Dan."
If you see something, say something. Gazing at the poster plastered above the window of a downtown No. 6 local, courtesy of New York City's Metropolitan Transit Authority and Homeland Security, Lucinda can't help but think, with a hefty slice of irony, of Bitsy Sloan. The slogan brings to mind all those years, growing up, that Lucinda would see something, something no one else could see, and say something, much to her mother's mortification. People would react any number of ways, depending on the vision she'd shared, sometimes with shocked recognition of some personal detail Lucinda couldn't have possibly known. They'd start asking questions. Questions her mother refused to let her answer, of course. Mostly, though, those to whom she described her visions were confused and looked to Bitsy Sloan, who would nervously laugh it off. "Lucinda is always making up little stories in her head,"
she would explain with forced affection, as if she considered her daughter's so-called creativity a charming quirk of character, rather than a ticket to the loony bin. God forbid mother bring her to a child psychiatrist who might actually diagnose a distasteful flaw in the sole heiress to the Sloane fortune. If you see something, please don't say anything. That was mother's credo. Lucinda learned, eventually, temporarily, for the sake of survival in the Stone Mansion, to live with it. And when, at last, she left the Stone Mansion, she learned not only to trust her visions, but to channel them into her own unique brand of Sloane philanthropy. If you see something, don't just say something. Do something. She hasn't seen her mother since the day of their curtailed brunch, nor has she called. But maybe she should, one of these days. Her mother isn't getting any younger. No, she isn't getting more tolerant or easygoing either. Bitsy Sloane is who she's always been. And so am I. Only, Lucinda watched Cam this morning as she nursed and bathed and cuddled little Grace, then as she kissed a bleary-eyed Tess goodbye and sent her out the door to school. For the first time, she found herself wondering what it would be like to have children of her own. She found the concept both terrifying and intriguing, and she wondered what kind of mother she would be. Nothing like my own mother, was the first thing that popped into her head. Then it struck her that a young Bitsy Sloane, when imagining what her future daughter might be like, probably hadn't envisioned one like Lucinda either. I am who I am. She is who she is. Yeah. Maybe she'll call her mother one of these days. The subway pulls into the Astor Place station, and Lucinda disembarks with a horde of other passengers, many of whom appear to be NYU students headed for late morning classes. She emerges onto the street. Spring is in the air today, sunshine and a comfortable breeze blowing off the nearby East River. As she looks around to get her bearings, she hears her phone beep, indicating that a new voicemail came in while she was underground. She pulls the phone from her pocket and examines the screen. There's not just a voicemail, there's a text message, too, from an unfamiliar number. Voicemail first, because she knows who it's from. Lucinda, it's Randy. I've been thinking about you. Not worrying, thinking, okay? Call me when you get this. She will call him, but not now, from the street in Manhattan. She opens the text message. Reading it, she realizes that the nightmare has begun again, just as she'd known it would. Danielle awakens to the ringing of the telephone and a bedroom splashed with too much sunlight sneaking in through the cracked blinds. Groggy, she fumbles for the phone on the bedside table.
Hello?
Danielle, are you all right?
Alicia?
She rubs the sleep from her eyes. What's going on? I just found out you weren't here and I was worried.
Here? Where?
Work. HR said you didn't call in sick. After what you told me last night about, you know, that guy Ethan stalking you, I thought I'd better check on you.
Ethan? Stalking?
Oh, that's right. It comes back to her. She talked to Ethan last night after she found that book, Goodnight Moon, on her doorstep. After determining there was no message or invitation within the pages, she poured herself a glass of wine and tried to watch TV for a while to unwind. A little later, still vaguely uneasy, she took an Ambien before bed. A pharmacist's label on the orange prescription bottle warns that you're not supposed to combine the medication with alcohol, but she knows from experience that it's not going to hurt her. Not just one pill. After just one glass of wine. It was her own personal sleep prescription back during the stressful post-divorce days. Works every time. Maybe too well, she realizes, glancing at the clock and startled to see that it's past 10.
So, are you sick? Alicia is asking. No, but I must have forgotten to set the alarm last night. Tell them I'm on my way, okay?
She's already out of bed, heading toward the adjoining bathroom. 10 minutes later, showered and dressed in a pale yellow spring suit, she hurriedly throws mascara, eyeliner, and lipstick into her bag to apply on the commuter train. Then she shoves her feet into a pair of heels, dashes down the stairs, and hurries into the kitchen to grab her BlackBerry. It isn't there. Momentarily taken aback, she eyes the black charger cord dangling empty from the kitchen outlet, where she always keeps it. Then she remembers how discombobulated she was when she got home last night, because of the package. She apparently forgot to plug in her BlackBerry. It must still be in her bag. She's good to go. She all but runs out the front door, but takes the time to be doubly sure it's locked behind her. You can't be too careful, Danielle Hendry thinks, just before she hears the voice directly behind her. Oh dear, it looks like someone overslept. Then the laughter begins. 104.5, 39.4. Lucinda stares at the text message. Jamie Dobiak's bedside radio had been tuned to 104.5. She'd known it was no accident. And that magazine. All this time, she's been wondering about the strange trade journal found on Jamie Dobiak's nightstand. Was a girl who subscribed to Cosmopolitan and Glamour also interested in social history? Or had the killer left it there as a clue? The latter. She should have checked last night when she'd seen that Meanderings magazine on her coffee table, and it had occurred to her. 19.04. Volume 19, Issue 4. Journal of Social History, Summer 2006, Volume 39, Issue 4. She can see it so clearly, even now. 39.4. How could I have missed it? Lucinda reaches Neil on the first try, pressing the phone hard against her ear and sticking her finger in the other one to drown out the sirens racing down the Bowery. Lucinda, where are you?
On the street in New York. Where are you? Are you near a computer?
I'm at my desk. What do you need?
I just got a text message from a number I don't recognize.
What's the area code? I'll check it.
No, wait. First, check these numbers against a longitude and latitude chart. 104.5 and 39.4. That's all that was in the message. He curses under his breath.
Just the numbers?
Yes. He asks her to repeat them.
All right, I'm looking them up. Hang on.
She looks around the bustling street, suddenly feeling vulnerable out in the open like this. What if he's here somewhere, lost in the crowd, watching her? She pulls her sunglasses from her bag and puts them on.
Oh, great. Great disguise. He'll never find you now. I've got it, Neil announces in her ear. It's Denver.
Denver. She immediately steps onto the curb, facing oncoming traffic, and starts looking for a vacant cab. He's moved on again.
Looks that way.
Something's going to happen there, and it's going to be today.
Are you sure?
Pretty much. Last night I had this crazy dream about a bloody knife and a night watchman, and the moon was full. The moon is going to be full tonight. I checked when I got up and...
Wait a minute. What did you say?
I said I had a dream about the full moon and a bloody knife.
And a night watchman?
Yes, All at once, the phrase slams into her. Oh my God, Neil.
There was a serial killer years ago.
I know, everyone knows.
Not a night watchman. The night watchman. A transient serial killer who snuck into random victims' homes in the night and stabbed them to death. He was never caught. He struck on nights when the moon was full, Neil tells her.
Are you sure about that?
Positive. I studied that case. It was early in my career, and I remember...
Neil, check the dates,
she cuts in hurriedly. Jamie died on March 20th, and Carla was about a month earlier.
I know. I'm checking.
A yellow cab pulls up beside Lucinda. She opens the back door and hops in.
Where to?
She gives the driver the address of the Midtown garage where she parked her car.
The moon was full on March 20th, Neil says in her ear. And on February 21st.
It was. She knew it was. Moonlight Sonata. Moonstruck. Goosebumps creep over her skin. Do you think this is the night watchman again? She asks Neil.
Could be. That or a copycat. It was all over the press that the guy killed at night during a full moon.
What about the wristwatches? Or the red lipstick? See if you can find anything about the night watchman using it to write messages. She almost slipped about the victims being found with red lipstick smeared on their lips. But Rheingold told her that it was classified information, and true to her word, she hadn't told a soul.
I'm looking,
Neil tells her, as she watches buildings and cars and people flash by out the window of the cab. Lucinda herself has already searched the internet repeatedly, looking for clues to past crimes with links to red lipstick or watches. She found nothing. Surely, if the notorious night watchman had a lipstick fetish or left his victims with watches that were stopped at the time they died, she'd have found it.
You still there, Sin?
I'm still here.
Nothing about red lipstick, but I got a bunch of hits about an ex-FBI agent who's writing a book on the case. His name's Vic Shattuck.
Can you find out how I can get in touch with him, please, Neil? But first, I need to know my options for getting to Denver.
What? When are you going to Denver?
Now. Blondie's out cold, lying in the back of the van with Bob's carpet cleaning emblazoned on the side of it. He'd found it parked on a relatively secluded neighborhood driveway one morning a while back and had been keeping an eye on it, noticing that no one ever seemed to use it during the day. The owner, who lives alone, works 9 to 5 somewhere else and uses the van for his part-time business at night and on the weekends. He figured no one would notice if he borrowed it for a little while, nor would anyone think twice if they spotted a carpet-cleaning van parked right in front of her townhouse, with the doors wide open. Sure, there was a 10, maybe 15-second window when he did risk being discovered as he approached Danielle Hendry at her front door, delivered his strategically placed blow to her skull, and tossed her into the van. In broad daylight, anyone could have seen. Yes, and it was all the more thrilling for him to drive away, confident that no one had. He hadn't been sure he was going to like doing it this way, going to all the trouble of transporting her away from home. But once he decided to let his friends back east know where to look for him, he knew he had to shake things up a little. They'll be expecting him to do what he had always done. They have no idea that he's much too smart to be that predictable at this stage of the game. He takes a detour to the commuter lot where he parked his own car earlier, in convenient walking distance to the van owner's driveway. At this time of morning, the lot is full, and there isn't a soul to catch a glimpse of him transferring his human cargo from the back of the van to the trunk of his car. She's dead weight, and he checks her pulse below her ear to make sure that she isn't dead. No, thank goodness. That wouldn't be any fun at all. For the first time today, he gets a good look at her face and notes that she isn't wearing lipstick. What a shame.
I'll fix that for you soon, I promise, he croons, before closing the trunk and leaving her there while he returns the van, knowing Bob will never be the wiser.
Frank, my name is Mary, the heavy-set, jolly-looking woman on his doorstep announces. It's good to meet you.
He shakes her hand, but says nothing. What is there to say? It's not good to meet her. It's a nightmare to meet her,
the woman sent by the hospice to help him die. They have other names for it. Palliative care is one, but that's what it comes down to. Why sugarcoat the truth?
Come on in.
He leads the way into the condo, conscious of his shuffling footsteps, but unable to do anything about it. He tried to clean up the place this afternoon, in anticipation of his first visitor in months, but he was too exhausted to do much more than load the dishwasher and stack the newspapers on one end of the coffee table.
Do you want to be in the living room or at the kitchen table?
Wherever you're most comfortable, Frank.
Comfortable?
Ha. Where he's most comfortable is in his office down at the police station, but he hasn't been there in a couple of weeks now, and this morning he was forced to announce that this is no temporary medical leave of absence, that he's never going back. He sent the email, signed off the computer, and has no intention of going back on, at least not anytime soon. He can't bear the inevitable awkwardness or, far worse, the pity.
We can sit in the living room,
he decides, and asks, just to show her that he's no invalid, yet, anyway.
Can I get you something to drink?
Double Grey Goose martini straight up, no olive. Frank's eyes widen. Mary laughs a booming laugh and jabs him with a chubby index finger.
Gotcha.
Oh, good one.
He manages a smile. To his surprise, Mary's little joke actually makes him feel better, unlike the overt cheer of the MRI nurse, whom he had the displeasure of seeing again the other day. But Mary isn't here to kid around, he knows. She's here to talk to him about what lies ahead, to discuss a DNR and getting his financial affairs in order and appointing a healthcare proxy, perhaps the trickiest part of the process, as Frank has yet to tell his family what's going on. It just doesn't seem appropriate to break the news over the phone. He supposes he'll have to, since the kids have no plans to visit anytime soon. He doesn't intend to be a burden on them, though. On anyone. That's why he agreed to hospice care, at Dr. Rubin's urging. At yesterday's appointment, he again pressed the oncologist to tell him how much time he has left. Again, the doctor punted. All he would say was that, statistically speaking, Frank's odds of being here 6 months from now are about 50-50. Numbers. Again. Frank's thoughts automatically flip to the murder case he turned over to Dan Lambert. The FBI has been brought in under the assumption that Carla Barakat's death was the work of a serial killer, just as Neil Bullard suspected in the first place. Frank supposes he owes him a phone call one of these days, just to clear the air, settle affairs, as it were. But not today.
Well, Mary says, shall we get started?
It's been a bad morning. It has been since everyone left, anyway. Mike and Tess headed for work and school, Lucinda on her way to Manhattan not long after. Left alone in the house with the baby, Cam had called her father to check in. Sometimes when she calls him, he's surprisingly lucid. Not today. She couldn't understand what he was saying, and she's pretty sure it was mutual. When she promised to come visit him in a day or two, he said that would be good, then asked who she was. After hanging up the phone, she did her best to distract herself with housework, only to be interrupted by a premonition. She hasn't had one in a while. The vision involved a stranger, as they almost always do. This time, a pretty girl in her late teens, maybe college-aged. But she looked as though she had stepped out of an era long past. Her brunette hair was done up in an old-fashioned style, like something out of I Love Lucy. She had on a vintage-looking dress with shoulder pads and dark red lipstick. Terrible bloody things happened to the girl in the vision. As Cam, shaken, wrote down all the details in one of her marble notebooks, she wondered whether it was a true premonition, or had she seen something that happened decades ago? If so, why now?
And why does she feel such an odd sense of connection to the girl? Has she seen her before, maybe? Whatever the case, the experience left her unsettled and drained, as such visions always do. She spent the last couple of hours absently tidying the house and playing with the baby, and is about to feed her when the phone rings. She recognizes the number. Lucinda, calling from her cell phone. Kim's first thought is that she must already have news from NYU. Then she looks at her watch and realizes Lucinda would have gotten to Manhattan less than an hour ago. Not enough time for her to have tracked down Professor William Zubin, particularly if she'd used the parking pass Mike had given her for a midtown garage and taken the subway down from there. Maybe she's still on the road, having car trouble or something. Cam picks up the phone.
Lucinda, where are you?
In the car. I'm on my way to the airport.
What? Why?
I got a text message a little while ago with the longitude and latitude coordinates for Denver. That's where I'm going.
But who sent the message?
Neil is getting the number traced. I guess it's from him. Cam doesn't have to ask whom.
Lucinda, you're crazy to go running out there. That's what this guy wants.
I know, and I'd be crazy not to go out there. This is a chance to catch him, Cam. I've got to do whatever I can. It's better than idly sitting around here waiting for something horrible to happen to someone. Cam thinks of the girl in the strange vintage clothing and hairstyle.
You're right. It is better. Just be careful.
Vic is sitting in a cafe nursing his third cup of coffee when his cell phone rings. The call is from his editor in New York. Oh, geez. He doesn't feel like dealing with book business now, when he's here in the middle of, well, nothing, really. What else have you got to do? Hello? Victor, it's Janine. Hi, Janine. What's up?
I just got a call from someone wanting to get in touch with you, and I didn't want to give out your number.
Thank you. That's appreciated. He lifts his coffee to his mouth and asks before taking a sip, who was it?
I wrote down her information in case you want to call her back. Her name is, let's see, Lucinda Sloan.
Lucinda Sloan, he repeats, wondering why that name rings a bell.
She said to tell you to please, please call her back. She said it's about the night watchman.
Vic promptly lowers the coffee cup, digs a pen out of his jacket pocket.
What's the number?
Janine gives it to him, and he jots it on a slightly rumpled napkin.
Oh, and she said that if you're going to call her, you should do it right away because she's on her way to the airport to catch a plane.
Thanks, Janine. He all but hangs up on her. He dials the number written on the napkin, processing the name through his brain like he's feeding data into a search engine. Lucinda Sloan. Lucinda Sloan. Definitely familiar, but he can't figure out why. She picks up on the first ring, sounding breathless.
Yes? Hello? Hello?
Ms. Sloan? This is Victor Shattuck.
Thank you for calling me back. Listen, I'm in the car, so if I lose you, I'll call you back, okay?
Okay, do we know each other?
No, I'm contacting you because I know you're writing a book about the Night Watchman murders. I'm a detective, and I'm working on a case now that has some similarities. And, look, let me just cut to the chase, because I'm about to drive through the Midtown Tunnel.
Midtown Tunnel? So she's in New York. Lucinda Sloan, detective, New York. Still no connection.
This guy has been contacting me.
Which guy? He holds his breath.
I'm pretty sure it's the night watchman. He's been in my apartment, and he was monitoring my computer, and he planted my DNA at the scene of a murder. It's a long story and complicated, and we should talk. But I'm about to fly to Denver because...
Denver? He cuts in.
Why are you flying to Denver?
Because that's where he is.
That's where I am.
Victor Shattuck feels as though he's just gotten the biggest break in his FBI career, until it hits him that he doesn't have one anymore.
When do you land?
5 o'clock your time. I'll call you when I get there.
Here comes the tunnel. I'm about to lose you.
Which airline?
United, he hears. And then the connection is broken.
So I talked to Victor Shattuck, Lucinda tells Neil over the phone, as she strides toward the terminal from the parking lot. Long term, which pretty much sums up her level of optimism that she'll be promptly winging her way back home, case closed.
Good. What did he say?
That he's in Denver.
No.
Oh, yes.
What is he doing there?
Same thing I am, I'm sure. Did you get an address from that phone number that sent the text message?
We're working on it. It's registered to a woman in Los Angeles.
A woman? She echoes. In Los Angeles?
Yes, a woman in Los Angeles. But anyone could have used the phone to send a text message.
So it was stolen?
Not reported to be. Anyway, we'll track her down and...
What about the phone? Where is it now? Can you have the signal tracked?
Working on that, too. Call me when you land. Have a safe flight, Sin.
I will.
It's not the flight she's worried about. Regaining consciousness, Danielle smells exhaust and mildew. Her skull throbbing with pain, she tries to open her eyes, but somehow can't. Then she realizes that they are open, and it's pitch black, and the bed is vibrating. No, she isn't in her bed. She feels thin, rough carpet against the side of her face. Bewildered, she tries to make sense of it. Is she in a car? A moving car? The trunk of a moving car? But how? It comes back to her slowly. She overslept. She was leaving for work. She walked outside, heard an unfamiliar voice, turned, and saw the van sitting just steps away from the door. And then, nothing. This can't be happening. Not to me. Please let it just be a dream. Oh, God. Oh, God. The horror of it swirls around her, settles over her like a clammy tarp. Someone knocked her out, abducted her. It isn't a dream. It's a nightmare. And she's not going to wake up.
Chapter 19. Lucinda. Startled to hear someone call her name as she walks into the Denver airport terminal from the gate, she looks around for a familiar face. There isn't one. For a split second, she wonders if it's him, lying in wait for her here, about to ambush her. In the middle of a crowded airport, surrounded by security and even uniformed cops? Not likely. Spotting an older, unfamiliar man waving at her, she approaches hesitantly, looking around to make sure there are plenty of big, strong guys in the vicinity. Lucinda Sloan?
Yes.
Victor Shattuck. Relieved, she shakes his hand.
You came out here to meet me?
I had time to kill. No pun intended.
She can't help but smile at his wry expression.
How did you know it was me? She asks him.
Like I said, I had time to kill. I looked you up on the internet. You've an impressive record, Miss Sloan. And as soon as I saw your photo, I knew why your name sounded so familiar. I saw you on television last year when you were looking into that old suicide case.
You have a good memory.
Goes with the territory. Did you find the information you were looking for back then?
No.
Does she dare tell him that the suicide might be tied into this case as well?
Not yet. Take it slowly.
Former FBI or not, the man is a total stranger. And right now, her instincts are telling her not to trust anyone.
Did you check luggage?
She shakes her head and shows him the overnight bag she'd brought with her to Cam's yesterday.
This is it. I left in a hurry.
So did I.
What brought you out here?
He sent an email from a hotel in Denver.
And?
And the FBI is on it. I'm just an author these days, so I have no clue what they've found so far.
How about you?
Have you found anything yet?
Working on it. I was at the hotel earlier. I've got a rental car. Come on.
Where are we going? Back to the hotel?
We could, but something tells me you might have a better idea.
She looks at him, wondering whether to trust him with the address Neil gave her when she called him right after she landed.
The police and the FBI will be there, Neil told her. They'll be expecting you.
As a potential witness or as a psychic?
Probably a little of both.
I don't know, she tells Vic, who's neither. I was going to rent a car of my own. He reaches abruptly into his pocket, and she instinctively winces, before she sees that he's merely pulled out his wallet.
What? Did you think I was going for a weapon?
Yes, she admits.
Good. Your guard is up. It should be.
He opens the wallet.
This is my ID, just so you know that I am who I say I am and not...
The night watchman? She leans in to inspect his identification.
Satisfied?
How do I know this isn't fake? How can I be sure you're not really him trying to trick me?
I guess you can never really be sure of anything, where he's concerned. And you shouldn't assume anything. Except that he's going to kill again, and again. And there's not a minute to waste.
She thinks that over for a long moment. Surely her instincts would warn her loud and clear if she were this close to the killer himself. Remembering that another woman's life might be hanging in the balance, she makes up her mind. All right, let's go. As he drives high into the mountains west of Denver, with the radio turned up to drown out the sound of thumping from the trunk, he has plenty of time to think. He thinks about Scarlett. She moved into the building when he was 17, and beginning to think that he'd never have what the other boys had. Sure, he wanted a girlfriend, had wanted one for a while by then. But girls didn't like him. He was too tall and gawky looking, and he never knew what to say or how to behave when he was around them, other than to laugh. His laughter made them nervous. Anyway, he was rarely around girls because he didn't have the freedom everyone else on the block had. Mama's boy, the kids always called him, when they weren't calling him hyena. He didn't mind so much when he was younger. Why would he? His mother took care of him, cooked for him and disciplined him when he was bad, and kept him locked inside to protect him from all the scary things that were out there, beyond the door of their South Bronx apartment. She couldn't protect his father, though. He'd been gunned down on the street one sunny afternoon. He remembers how they were walking along one minute, holding hands, and then there was a loud explosion, and then his father pulled him down as he fell. He remembers his father's blood everywhere, on the sidewalk, a red river spilling into the gutter. He remembers it, warm and sticky on his hands. Remembers putting his fingers into his mouth to get it off. Remembers the salty taste of his father's blood. Remembers the sirens and his mother's screams. She wasn't the same after that day. Neither was he. He was bad. Really, really bad. His mother had to discipline him all the time for his own good. "Don't you cry," she'd warn him. "Only babies cry." He remembers the salty taste of his own blood, too. Blood. Red. Scarlet. It always comes back to her. Beautiful Scarlet, as tall as he and a few years older, with a throaty, sexy voice and long, flowing hair and exotic false eyelashes and red lipstick to match her skin-tight dresses. "Do you wear red all the time because of your name?" he asked her one day as he helped her carry her groceries up the stairs to her apartment.
"I have my name because I wear red all the time," was her cryptic answer.
"You mean Scarlett isn't your real name?"
She smiled. "No."
"What is it?"
But she refused to tell him. He'd beg and tease, and she'd laugh at his guesses.
It became a game with them.
Is it Agnes? He'd ask. Helga? Hortense?
He never got it right. He was hoping he wouldn't, because then the game would have to end. Once, when he picked her a bouquet of wild sweet peas he found growing in the vacant lot, she kissed his cheek.
Thank you, lover boy, she said.
Later, he looked in the mirror and saw that her red, red lips were imprinted there on his skin. He didn't wash it off. Then his mother came home and saw it.
What is that?
She demanded suspiciously, gripping his jaw in the vise of her thumb and forefinger.
Where did it come from?
He pretended he had no idea. Of course, she didn't believe him. Of course, she punished him. For once, he didn't even flinch. It was worth it, because he had scarlet now. Then the punishment was over, or so he believed, and his mother made him get up off the floor.
You can march into the bathroom and wash that away right this instant, she told him.
And he thought she was talking about the blood coming from the slashes on his arms where his father's old belt had ripped open his skin. But she was talking about the lipstick on his face. When he wouldn't, couldn't move, she dragged him to the bathroom, and she scrubbed his face with scalding hot water and soap until the red lipstick kiss was gone. Only then did he flinch. Only then did he feel as though he was being punished. Still, he didn't cry. Only babies cry. And besides, he had scarlet.
Lucinda gradually allows herself to relax as Victor Shattuck drives along the streets of Denver in the glare of late-day sun, heading for the address Neil had given her. Danielle Hendry, the woman whose phone sent the text message, has gone missing. She overslept this morning, told a friend she was on her way to work, then never showed up. The friend did say that she had an acrimonious relationship with her ex-husband back in L.A., and that a former boyfriend had been stalking her. Vic Shattuck, of course, had known about none of this. He, in turn, has information for Lucinda. She isn't the only one who's been hearing from the night watchman these past few months. He's received several messages, the first of which coincided with Carla Barraquette's death.
How did you know it was from him?
Red lipstick.
Of course. Lucinda nods, glad he can't see her expression behind her sunglasses as he darts a glance at her.
Of course, he echoes.
The night watchman smeared it on his victim's lips.
How did you know that?
She didn't, for sure. Not until now.
And there were no exceptions, she guesses, her thoughts racing.
No? Why?
Before she can reply, he follows up with a question of his own. The victims in Beach Haven and Chicago, they were smeared with red lipstick too, weren't they? She hesitates. Then she levels a look at him.
How did you know that?
He gives a satisfied nod.
Touché.
So we have a pattern. He strikes when there's a full moon, women who live alone, and he has a red lipstick fetish. No sexual contact with the victims, though. Isn't that unusual?
No. It's a myth that serial killers are always sexually motivated. Most are, but some aren't.
So, he's unusual.
In more ways than that. Most serial killers tend to stick fairly close to home, within their comfort zone. The night watchman never did. He struck randomly up and down the East Coast. This time, he appears to be moving east to west instead. But he once again favors metropolitan areas, probably because the population is transient and he'll be less visible.
And did he leave an engraved wristwatch on the wrists of his victims?
Vic looks at her, and she has her answer. He didn't know about this.
That's a new trick.
Watch, watchman. He wants no mistake made about who is behind this new wave.
What does the engraving say?
date the victim was killed and the longitude and latitude, and he removes the battery after the victim dies so that the watch stops. Looking thoughtful, Vic asks her to repeat that. Then he shakes his head, decisively. He isn't removing the battery after the victim dies. He's removing it before.
What do you mean? How do you know?
Because 3 days before Jamie Dobiak died, he sent me a message that gave not just the date, but the exact time of her death. Did she die at 7:05 p.m.?
Around then.
Her thoughts tumble over each other.
So he's planning the murders right down to the minute?
It looks that way. The numbers have some significance to him.
We have to tell the FBI.
Vic flashes her a grim smile. Trust me, they're on it. They have all the pieces and the technology and manpower and resources to put them together. I guarantee you, they're way ahead of us.
Maybe so, she thinks.
But they're operating with just 5 senses.
Lucinda has 6.
Can I ask you something about the Night Watchman's crimes in the past, Mr. Shattuck? Call me Vic. She tells him briefly about Ava Neary and her original suspicion that she might have been one of the Night Watchman's earliest victims. He's shaking his head before she even finishes speaking. I don't think so. You said he threw her from a rooftop?
Yes.
Too many things don't fit. The Night Watchman always used a knife. He always killed the victim in her home, and he always staged the victim with the lipstick. It would be awfully challenging to stage a body that's fallen out of the sky, for one thing. And for another, this took place a while after he killed his last known victim, Judy Steinberg. He never let more than a month or two go by between murders, unless he committed a bunch of murders that were undetected between Judy Steinberg and Ava Neary. And unless he completely changed his M.O., I'd say there's no way in hell he killed Ava.
Then who did? Lucinda wonders grimly as they turn onto Danielle Hendry's street.
Hello?
Is this Dr. William Zubin?
Yes, it is.
It is. It's him.
Cam grips the edge of the kitchen counter to steady herself. Who's calling, please?
Ignoring the question, she tells him, just as she practiced, I attended a discussion you recently gave at the Museum of Natural History, and I was wondering if you would mind meeting with me to answer a few questions I have.
She holds her breath, praying he'll say yes, knowing that it's a long shot. Are you a student?
Yes.
And your name is?
Claire Montgomery.
She was prepared for the question. Montclair. Claire Montgomery. The lies are stacking up, but she doesn't dare tell him any semblance of the truth, mindful that if he really did have anything to do with Ava's death and any inkling that she's Ava's sister, he'd never in a million years agree to speak with her. It might even be dangerous.
I could meet with you at your convenience, Dr. Zubin, and I won't take up much of your time at all.
My dear, I have all the time in the world these days, he tells her with a good-natured chuckle.
Hearing it, she wonders if she's barking up the wrong tree. Does she really believe this kindly-sounding old man is a cold-hearted killer?
You believe, no, you know, that he cheated on his wife and took advantage of an innocent young girl.
Okay, true. But everyone makes mistakes. A lot of people are immoral. It doesn't make them murderers.
Why don't you name the time and place, Ms. Montgomery?
She hesitates, wondering if she should just forget the whole thing. But regardless of whether he had anything to do with her sister's death, he was involved with Ava shortly before it happened. He might know something. She suggests meeting at the Starbucks on Astor Place at 7:30. Mike will be home by then. Ordinarily, Cam wouldn't hesitate to leave the baby with just Tess, but she isn't sure Tess can handle the responsibility. These days, she can barely take care of herself.
I'm afraid I have other plans this evening, Dr. Zubin tells her.
I could meet you there tomorrow, though, at noon, if that works.
That's fine. She'll just have to bring Grace with her. Maybe that's better. In broad daylight, with the baby in tow, it's probably safer.
She hangs up the telephone.
We're going to find out what happened to your aunt, she tells little Grace, who looks up solemnly from her bouncy seat on the floor beside the desk. One way or another.
Vic slows the car as they cruise alongside a row of brick townhouses, their destination ahead made obvious by a couple of dark suburbans and a police cruiser parked at the curb. A rugged cop, who looks like he'd be right at home in a saddle out on the cattle range, steps out into the road, holding out his hand. Vic rolls down the window.
Do you live down this way, folks?
No, but we know there's an investigation. They're expecting us.
Who are you?
My name is Victor Shattuck, retired FBI. He shows ID. And I'm Detective Lucinda Sloan, she says, leaning across from the seat beside him.
Wait here.
As the cop steps away from the car and speaks into his radio, Vic reminds her in a low voice, They're not expecting me. They need all the help they can get. You'll be fine.
Is that a psychic observation?
She hesitates, then flashes him a grin. Sure, why not? Moments later, the cop simply waves them past. Vic looks at Lucinda.
You're either the real deal or your name has some serious pull.
Both, she tells him with a satisfied smile. The scene in front of the townhouse is discreet, as Vic expected. It isn't a crime scene, yet. He suspects they'll be canvassing the neighborhood if they aren't already. As Vic pulls into a parking space, he spots Annabelle Wyatt stepping out of the townhouse in a tailored black pantsuit, wearing an expectant look on her face.
Who's that? Lucinda asks.
My old boss.
Strictly no nonsense with her, huh?
Is that a psychic observation?
No, Lucinda says flatly. That's obvious. Annabelle strides toward them, arriving just as Vic turns off the ignition.
I didn't realize you two knew each other,
she greets him as he opens the car door.
Lucinda and me? No, we go way back.
Really?
No, that was a joke.
She just looks at him. I see she hasn't lost her sparkling sense of humor, Vic thinks.
Actually, we just met.
He gestures at Lucinda, coming around from the other side of the car.
Lucinda, this is Special Agent Annabelle Wyatt.
Annabelle, Lucinda Sloan, the famous psychic detective. Annabelle, he notices, doesn't bat an eye. So she knows exactly who and what Lucinda is. Interesting.
I don't ordinarily work with psychics, she tells Lucinda, though some agents have. But your colleague, Detective Bullard, tells me that you've got quite a track record with missing persons, and frankly, we've got nothing to lose. I'd like you to come inside and see what you can tell us.
Absolutely.
Annabelle turns to Vic.
I'd appreciate your input as well.
He raises an eyebrow.
Really? I heard what happened last night, the email. We know who we're dealing with. He's back. And he's obviously playing cat and mouse with you. With both of you.
She sweeps a long, elegant hand to include Lucinda. His moves are growing bolder.
So will ours.
Let's go. Sitting on the rug before the open bureau drawer, Randy packs the last of Carla's jeans into a cardboard box to be donated to a women's shelter. He saved the bedroom, her clothes, for last. The rest of the house was relatively easy. There wasn't much to pack up, other than in the kitchen. Nothing sentimental about pots and pans, plates and utensils. No memories there. In the bathroom, where she died, he hurriedly swept the contents of the medicine cabinet and vanity into a black, hefty bag. Cosmetics, cleaning supplies, medication,
Everything went. Even the shrink-wrapped new bottle of cough medicine and unopened box of Advil. He simply couldn't bring himself to linger there long enough to sort through anything. It's different in the bedroom, with Carla's clothes. He's made a separate little pile of things to keep. Her favorite sweater, crocheted by her mother, that she pretty much lived in every winter. The tennis bracelet he'd given her on their first anniversary. Her wedding dress and veil, of course. He was surprised to find that she hadn't gotten rid of them. How could he be the one to toss them? There's no one upon whom he can bestow these things, but it would feel wrong to give them to strangers. He supposes he'll keep them as mementos of the woman with whom he shared his life for a while. The box is full. The drawer is empty. He closes it, stands, and looks around. Tomorrow, they'll come to cart the furniture away into a storage unit he rented. He'll have his cottage through Memorial Day weekend. After that, the owners return, and he'll have to find a new place to live. It won't be easy during the high season on the island. Maybe he should move away, to the mainland. Back to Philly, maybe. But Lucinda made it clear that she isn't ready to let anyone, not even him, into her life. It's just not time yet, Randy thinks, as he walks back through the empty house. It's still too soon. Still too soon, he informs Danielle Hendry, who lies bound and gagged on the muddy ground. Relishing the terror in her eyes as she looks up at him, he taps the face of his watch. You've got about 10 minutes left. Do you have any last requests? I'll be happy to oblige, if I can. She grunts. He cups a hand behind his ear. What's that? You'll have to enunciate, dear. I can't understand a word you're saying. She writhes violently at his feet, spattering and smearing her pale yellow suit with even more mud. You know what you look like, he asks. An overripe banana. Delighted laughter bubbles out of him, mingling with the sound of the rushing water of a nearby stream rippling down the mountainside. The release feels good after all the long hours of self-restraint. She struggles on the ground, trying to roll away from him, as if she can actually go anywhere. He gives her a hard, sharp kick in the soft flesh between her hip bone and rib cage, and is rewarded by a primal howl. Primal. Primate, he thinks, and laughs even harder. You sound like a wounded ape. Ape. Banana. Get it? The laughter pours out of him, loud and strong, echoing in the Colorado wilderness, where there's no one to hear it. Just as there will be no one to hear her screams when she dies, 9 minutes from now, at precisely 7:44. Lucinda stands on the small balcony off Danielle Hendry's bedroom, gazing at the fiery ball of orange sinking low in a glowing sky over the distant Rockies. Somewhere inside, Vic and Annabelle and the others are following up on the information Lucinda was able to give them. It wasn't much to go on, though. She felt that Danielle had been abducted close to home, but not from inside the house, which was consistent with the fact that they'd found things undisturbed, no signs of a struggle. Yet when Lucinda walked through the house, through the kitchen, up the stairs, into the bedroom, she could feel him doing the same thing. He was inside, she told the agents. Before he abducted her? No, earlier. She was abducted during the day. He was inside at night, in the dark. And she was here, too, in the house. Did he take her hostage? Annabelle asked. No, she didn't know he was here. Lucinda shuddered, remembering her own vision back at home of someone stealing into her bedroom while she was asleep. It was so chilling that she found it difficult to focus on Danielle Hendry, though she tried her best for over an hour. There were framed photos around the house, of Danielle with friends and with her college-aged sons. In all of them, Lucinda noted. She wore red lipstick. She pointed it out to the others, speculating that it might have been what captured the night watchman's attention. Now, having stepped outside to get some fresh air and clear her head, she thinks again about what Victor Shattuck told her in the car. If the night watchman didn't kill Ava Neary, or, for that matter, Sandra Wubner and the other so-called suicides, then why did he want Lucinda to think he did? He could be playing with her, taunting her. Solve it, and if you are right, you will find me. It's almost as if, can he be giving them a clue to his own identity, rather than letting them know that he killed Ava and the others? Maybe he doesn't want her to think he did it. Maybe he's trying to tell her that in solving the mystery surrounding Ava's death, she'll unlock the key to the Night Watchman murders. As she watches the last sliver of sun disappear behind a distant peak, she hears a female scream so blood-curdling that she spins around in horror, thinking it came from right beside her. There's no one there. Beyond the French doors, which are ajar, she can see the others, can hear the murmur of their voices spilling out into the night. They obviously didn't hear the scream. Okay. So it came from inside your head? And so, she realizes a moment later, as another sound reaches her ears, did that. He's laughing again. He's killing again. Right now. Where? Where is he? Is he with Danielle? Is he killing Danielle? Lucinda squeezes her eyes shut, desperately trying to focus, trying to see her, to see him, to hear more than just that heinous laughter. She has to get into his head. Who is dying? Damn it. I need to see her. I need her name. Only one word comes to mind. Scarlet. The ground is soaked with Danielle Hendry's blood. It's likely to draw a good many creatures from their lairs now that night has fallen. He swings his flashlight beam over her face, admiring the fixed expression of terror in her eyes, and the way the blood dribbling from the corner of her mouth is the precise shade of her lipstick. He used her own this time, having found it conveniently located in her purse. He even made her put it on herself. But her hand was shaking so badly that she made a real mess of things. He waited until she was dead to touch it up and to fasten the watch around her wrist. Now everything is just right. It's a pity to leave her here, where she won't be found before the nocturnal animals come out to feed and destroy his tableau. But leave you I must, he tells her. It's time to move on. Is she finally asleep? Mike looks up from the opening pitch of the baseball game as Cam walks into the master bedroom. Which she? Grace. Isn't she the one you were putting to bed? She went right down. Then I looked in on Tess. I've been in with her this whole time. Did you talk some sense into her? Mike moves over and pats the spot next to him on the bed. He's shed his jacket and tie, but is still wearing the suit pants and dress shirt he'd had on when he walked in the door from work a half hour ago. Cam sits and pulls off her gold post earrings. I mostly just listened while she talked.
About him?
About why he doesn't love her anymore.
Did you tell her that there is no such thing as love when you're 14?
She's 15, Cam reminds him. And no, I didn't say that, because I don't believe it.
I hate seeing her this way.
He unbuttons his cufflinks. So do I. Do you think I should make an appointment for her to talk to someone? Mike looks at her.
Not yet. Give it another couple of days, and if she doesn't pull herself together, then we'll see.
He shakes his head. I still can't believe she managed to get through being abducted by a maniac and seeing someone die right in front of her with no problem. But this little jerk breaks her heart and she falls apart.
I'm wondering if everything is catching up with her now, though. Maybe this is a delayed reaction to all the stress of last summer. Speaking of which...
Uh-oh.
In the process of stripping off his shirt, he looks up expectantly. I'm going to talk to my sister's old geology professor tomorrow in the city.
Cam, you know I don't.
I have to do this, Mike.
It could be dangerous.
It won't be. My gut feeling about him is that he had nothing to do with Ava's death. Maybe it really was a suicide. Who knows?
Lucinda doesn't seem to think so.
Lucinda might be wrong.
Do you think she is?
I don't know, she admits. But I am pretty sure that if this Dr. Zubin were dangerous, I'd have a sense of it. And I don't.
You could be wrong.
I rarely am, she reminds him with a smile. And anyway, I'm meeting him in a public place, at a Starbucks in the village. Don't worry.
When, tomorrow?
Noon. Why?
I'll go with you.
He stands and tosses the shirt into the hamper.
You'll be at work. How are you going to get away in the middle of the day? You're lucky you got out of there at a decent hour tonight. I'll work it out. There's no way I'm letting you go talk to this guy alone.
Because you have a sense that he might be dangerous? She asks, rubbing her temples, thinking she's starting to feel a little bit dizzy.
Because I don't know what to think, and because you're my wife, and I love you.
Mike steps out of his dress pants and reaches for a wooden hanger.